Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics. Hi there, I'm DJ McGuire from Suffolk, Virginia, an economic conservative and a Republican until the 8th of June.
I'm Greg Matuszak. I'll be your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelton. I will be your moderate Democrat from Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Jonah Knight. I am a cranky independent until I die.
Whatever independence we can find is an open issue, but you can find us on the web at moreperfectunionpodcast.com, which includes blogs and commentary. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And of course, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, because, well, that's kind of cool. Oh yes, and don't forget to share our link on your Facebook news feed. We begin with the week that was in New York and the week that will be in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, and a couple of other places. It was a good week for the frontrunners. The frontrunners reestablished themselves and as the prohibitive favorites, most certainly more so on the Democratic side, perhaps. But I would say even on the Republican side, a Trump nomination seems to look inevitable once again. But we'll start on the Dem side. Kevin and Greg, when do you think the Burnmentum or the Bernie bots and everything else, when do you think they will become disillusioned and become burnouts?
I would say November 12th.
Yeah, it's there are some diehards, and you know it's really hard to, you know, explain basic math to a lot of the Bernie supporters, where you say it's just not gonna happen. No, this is a revolution. Numbers.
What I'm seeing, because I do a lot of discussions on Facebook, a lot of different people, is that they actually have accepted that he is not going to be the nominee anymore. Now it's about their feeling that he was ripped off, that the DNC and or the evil Clinton forces conspired to fix, you know, the elections in Brooklyn and in Arizona and every other state that Bernie didn't win. Apparently they never attempted to fix the elections in the states that Bernie did win. But right. The other thing that I'm seeing, of course, is the Bernie or bust thing is playing out now, you know, full scale. And that's the war that I see ongoing.
Right. They fall into two categories. The, you know, I'm really kind of bummed this didn't happen. I'm still active, and I'm still going to vote for Bernie till the end, but we're going to vote for Hillary. And we're seeing that with a lot of, well, gosh, it didn't happen, and I'm kind of bummed about this. And then you have the diehards who are like, Hillary's a terrible person, and she's just as bad. And although Bernie Sanders and Hillary voted 93% of the time exactly the same while they were in the Senate, they are completely... Hillary is a... what's the word? Neo-corporate liberal capitalist Democrat. I don't even know all the words, because there's a lot of them. And she's opposite of what Bernie Sanders stands for, and it would be better for her to go down in flames with him and have you know, somebody else. And they don't even know who else, because they've never actually looked past the primaries. You know, and it's just as long
Then I have another question, because 2008 was my first election as a blogger, and I remember coming across a whole bunch, and actually interacting with a whole bunch of bloggers who called themselves PUMAs, which was short for Party Unity My Ass. These are apparently diehard Hillary Clinton supporters, at least one of whom I know actually switched over to McCain Palin. Most of the others just apparently stayed home or something. The diehards that you talk about, are they more prevalent or stronger than the PUMAs of 2008? Are they less? I mean, give us, who are outside the party, an idea of the comparison between the PUMAs and the diehard Bernie folks of today.
I would say they're stronger, but in the same instance, though, these are not people, the diehards haven't been with the party for years. These are not capital D Democrats, and they're younger, and... You know, and when we say, well, what about being a Democrat. They go, well, we don't care about Democrats. We don't care about the down tickets. We don't care about these things. And I said, well, you're not really a Democrat. No, we're independents. So we never really counted on these guys' votes to begin with. So.
Right. And yeah, it feels stronger to me, too. But I think that a lot of that may be a function of the fact that social media is a tenfold bigger force than it was even in 2008. So I wasn't coming into contact with Pumas in 2008. I heard of them. I knew about their cause. I see them on television news being interviewed. But I wasn't interacting with them on a daily basis as I am now with the Burn or Bust people. And they're pretty hardcore.
Understood.
I think that there are definitely a lot of people that would, of the people that prefer Bernie to Hillary, the people that are more likely to go to Hillary are the folks that I think remember 2000. And, I mean, at that point, because I think I've said before sort of in passing, but I did go to a Nader rally that year. And, you know, there was a lot of talk at that point where the Democrats are so much like the Republicans, one vote is as good as another, and it was mostly Nader that was perpetuating this idea. And I think that if you remember that, then this argument of Republicans are the same as Democrats, I think that that was the last election that that argument worked on anyone. And I think that the ones that are sort of not going to give up on Sanders are the younger ones, or the ones who were never, as you were saying, the ones who were never really Democrat, never really in the party loyalists, or too young to remember the last time this argument kind of worked.
Right.
Or blew up in our face.
Go ahead, Kev.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to build on Jonah's thought. Those who are too young to remember 2000, that basically means you're talking about voters in the 18 to 22 or 24 range, which we never counted on anyways. You know, in any contested primary, some portion of the party base in both parties is not going to show up for the person who ultimately gets the nomination. There's no 100% turnout for anyone. So, you know, if the Democrats lose 10% of the so-called Bernie bots or Bernie or bust people, we were going to lose them anyways. They were just going to be people who just weren't motivated to vote for a particular candidate, in this case Hillary Clinton. In terms of whether it's going to hurt us in the fall, let's remember there are five states where, you know, in my opinion, that are make-or-break states in this election. We're talking about Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida,
Virginia.
Virginia, thank you. And you know, throw in maybe one other, you know. Well, those are the
Colorado.
Okay, those are the swing states. Remember that of those, the big ones are Ohio and Florida. Florida is where Nader did tremendous damage to Gore, and those Democrats remember it even better than those of us who weren't living in Florida at the time. And Ohio had some problems in 2004 for Kerry. So I really don't know whether there's enough Bernie bots out there in those three to five states to turn the election.
So, and just to correct one point, it wasn't Nader that did the damage. It was Gore that did the damage to himself by losing his home state. So we can go on by that.
I would respectfully disagree. Joni, you and I have never gotten into it here, but this may be the day that the gloves come off. Because there were 92,000 Nader voters in Florida that year, if I have my numbers correct.
And sure.
Don't tell me that 537 more of them weren't going to be Gore voters than Bush voters.
How many people voted for the Constitution Party in Florida that year? Since you know the Nader numbers, do you remember the Constitution Party?
I don't.
They got more votes than the difference between Gore and Bush. How many votes did Buchanan get? He got more votes than the difference between Gore and Bush in Florida. It was not
but
Nader.
But Nader got 92,000.
Because
he
was
in a couple of different states, by the way.
He was, but you can't say that that's Nader's fault. I will say that that is Gore's fault for not being a good candidate. And this, if Hillary Clinton loses, it's going to be for the same reason. It's because she is not, however qualified she is on the campaign trail, she has the same issues that Gore does. She is not inspiring the same passion that, for better or for worse, that Sanders is doing.
And I would counter that is a convenient argument. Let me just finish this. That is a convenient argument for people who want to, you know, try to dilute the two-party system. It's supposed to be a binary choice. I know this is not going to be a popular argument, but, you know, American politics is generally a binary choice. Yes, we do have third parties and independent candidates, but if you sit it out and you're, you know, a Democrat and you make this argument, well, Hillary Clinton didn't motivate me to go to the polls, it's not on me that that we get a President Trump or a President Cruz. It's not on me that we get the next Antonin Scalia. It's on you for not showing up for the Democratic choice. Okay, I'm done.
All right.
Well,
for the
I'm not done with that.
I want all of you to stop.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because you have mentioned President Trump and President Cruz, which brings it to the other side coming out of New York, which made it where it became far more likely that Donald Trump might actually get to 1,237 delegates and kick me out of the party on the 8th of June, or encourage me to leave, I should say. It was a very good, from my perspective, it was obviously a very good night for Trump. He beat expectations. He beat his poll numbers, which is something he hasn't done in a while. It was a very bad night for Cruz, and it was an irrelevant night for John Kasich. He got his first two or three delegates since Ohio. Yay for him.
I think that's
but it wasn't nearly enough for him to be relevant.
Irrelevant.
Well, that may be. But he is not relevant in Pennsylvania. The polling shows that he is still in third place in most of the polling, behind Cruz and behind Trump. And really, I think what folks are now saying is that based on what happened in New York and what we expect to happen in Pennsylvania and other places, it is likely that Trump will end up certainly north of 1,100. He may even hit 1,200, in which case it will be very difficult, I think, to deny him 1,237 on the first ballot. If he wins Pennsylvania, for example, which it looks like he will, those 57, there are a whole bunch of unpledged delegates who will be elected district-wide because we don't know who they're attached to, and they're not, apparently according to the way Pennsylvania does things, they don't need to say it, and none of them are. But I would be very surprised if they Trump doesn't at least pick up a few of those if he wins the state. From my perspective, and I'm jumping into this because I'm the only Republican in the group here, New York was a reminder of the real disconnect between the party leadership and the party voters. That's been no surprise. We've known that for months. But it was more troubling for me because it was yet another reminder that Donald Trump's big government for white people message has a lot more resonance with Republicans than I thought it did, than anybody thought it did. And whatever happens, I think Jonah Goldberg put it in a National Review column, he said, well, whatever happens, this is going to end in tears. There's going to be a schism. There's going to be a split. And it's not going to be good. The question is going to be, what does the Republican Party choose to do, and what does the conservative movement choose to do? Does the conservative movement decide, you know, to heck with Kevin Kelton and his binary nonsense, we're going off on our own, we are either going to work within the Libertarian Party, we're going to work within the Constitution Party, I have my preference on that, I won't say it now, or something. Or does the movement, frankly, just scatter to the four winds, which is a distinct and painful possibility, at least it is to me. But I guess to make a very long story short, Trump's victory in New York brought back to us the choice, the painful choice, that we thought we could avoid when Cruz did so well in Wisconsin. And it's essentially, do we just accept Trump and deal with it, or do we accept that we will reject, or do we reject Trump and in the process reject a lot of his voters and to go forward we must go back, to use House Targaryen's phrase from Game of Thrones, which was premiered an hour earlier. That's the choice we have, and New York reminded us that that choice is still there, and we still have to make it.
I mean,
I would just be so honored. I would just want to say I would be so honored if the conservative movement was all sitting around talking about Kevin Kelton and his binary choice. Go ahead.
I just can't see the Republican Party saying, "Yeah, we've got a front runner. He's 50 delegates away, and we're just going to say no, no, not going to happen." I mean, it's.
Well, I have always said that Trump's best ballot will be his first ballot.
Right. Well, that goes without saying.
If he can get to 1237, then that's it. If he gets to 1200 on the first ballot and he can't get over that, he will start to fall. He will start to dip.
Oh, there's a 538.
The question
538 has a an interactive website where if you add up and it does all the things, and even if Trump has his best days, wins Nebraska, which I don't think he's going to do, takes Indiana, and has his best days, even, you know, two or three more delegates on everything, the best I've ever gotten him up to, it's like a video game for me, I play with this site all the time, is he will only need like 22 delegates. Okay? And the worst, you know, at the worst, if he has his worst days ever, he'll need 130 delegates. Okay? So
if that's the range, I can say if he's at the upper tier of that range, if he only needs maybe two or three dozen delegates, he will probably get it from all the unpledged delegates that are out there that Cruz has not gotten his meat hooks into. And there are plenty of there are enough of those out there, I think, that he can pull that off. There's also the fact that, and this is just something that is much more painful for me, you're starting to see a lot more of the establishment types in the Republican Party sort of, you know, they're hitting the transition stage of Stockholm syndrome, where they're warming up to Trump, and they're listening, they're actually believing Paul Manafort when he says, "Oh, it's just an act and he's gonna act better later on." The New York party was pretty much all in for him, even though, you know, was his home state and all. But I'm starting to see from a lot of establishment types in the Republican Party the beginning of that, the notion that they can accept Donald Trump as a nominee, which means if he is two or three dozen delegates short, they'll probably get it for him because in their mind that's better than a convention fight, or giving it to Ted Cruz, who they don't think will win, or giving it to John Kasich, who they really can't stand, or giving it to somebody who has not even run, which I don't know if the rest of the party will handle that. So if he gets that close, then he'll probably get what he needs from the unpledged delegates, in which case, again, sorry, Kevin, but for a lot of us, it just happens that Kevin threw it out there. For a lot of us, the binary choice will be a false choice, and we won't take it.
So do you think...
Well,
so this,
of course,
this
I'd be
idea
thrilled
of,
if the Republicans would, you know, split up. But go ahead, Jonah.
Well, if never Trump does put up a... I don't imagine that a third-party candidate can actually win, or even win a plurality of the Republican votes during, the general. But is there a candidate, DJ, that you think Never Trump, if they did put someone up who could get on most all the states, that you would be proud of? Like who at this point, are there names that you've heard of where you've thought, oh, I hope it's that guy?
Well, I will acknowledge I come at this from a somewhat different perspective than most of the Never Trump crowd. That is to say, if the Libertarian Party were to nominate Gary Johnson, for example, I would have to give him a very long look. He was a very good governor of New Mexico. He has already run before. He has political experience. I have said jokingly on Facebook that if I went that way, then the Libertarian Party would suddenly have to come to terms with the fact that it had a neoconservative wing, or at least a neoconservative feather. But you know, from my perspective, Gary Johnson would be someone that I could probably, for whom I could cast a vote and be okay. I don't know if a lot of the other Never Trumps could say that. They may try to get somebody to win the Constitution Party nomination, because the Constitution Party has ironically done this before in Colorado when they ran Tom Tancredo for governor, and he very nearly won because Republicans were so upset at the guy who won the primary. I forget his name. I don't know if they could pull that off at a national level. They certainly can't do it on the libertarian side because their nominee is going to be done by the 27th of May. My point is, they will probably try something. I don't know what they're going to try. I don't know what they have in mind. What I know myself is that if the libertarians nominate Johnson, I have a backup. And a lot of people who are, say, small L libertarians in the Never Trump group would probably go to Johnson and may just go to the libertarians in general and actually give them, not give them enough to win a state or two, because I don't think they can, I don't think there's enough of us to do that. But there may be enough of us to trigger the ballot access laws to get the libertarians on permanently in more than a few states, in which case we could be looking at least temporarily, a three-party system. And then those of us will have to look at, okay, is it a matter of the Republican Party trying to recover from Donald Trump, or the conservative movement saying, you know what, the Republican Party's too tainted, we're going to build something up to replace it, as Republicans replaced the Whigs in the 1850s, and as Whigs and National Republicans sort of replaced the Federalists in the 1820s. That's a lot harder to do now because of ballot access laws, no doubt. But if we decide, you know, the Republican Party is simply too tainted, and everybody under 30 will certainly be screaming it at us anyway, we may have to look at just building another option from scratch.
I think it has.
What we have to do.
Yeah, I think it has to be something like that because, I mean, if you're economically conservative these days and you're kind of young, I can't see how how solidified the religious right is in the Republican Party. I can't see how that makes that a real viable option for a lot of the kids. You know, like I think it does.
Yeah, and the thing that yeah. Exactly, Jonah. And the thing that Kevin and Greg maybe probably don't see because it's not something they notice, and it may not be something you see as much, Jonah, up in Maryland, is where social conservatives are strong within the Republican Party, where the religious right is strong, if you will, the Republican Party has a bad addiction to tax hikes. Here in the old Confederacy, all 11 states over the last 15 years have seen a Republican governor or Republican legislature enact tax increases. You know, Bob Novak once said the entire purpose of the Republican Party, is to oppose tax increases. That's his whole point. That was his whole purpose. I've got the line screwed up. But for those of us who still remember that, and for those of us who still think that, social conservatives have been making it harder and harder and harder and harder with every passing year. And for a lot of us, Trump will end up being really the straw that breaks the camel's back. And the only reason, frankly, that Ted Cruz would not be the straw that breaks the camel's back is because he himself is such a hardcore economic conservative in a way that nobody else who claims to be a social conservative ever is, was, or will be. Ted Cruz is the exception that proves the rule on that. But for a lot of us who are economically conservative, as you say, the social conservatives aren't just making it harder to be in the party. The social conservatives don't really agree with us on economic issues, and they're not exactly quiet about it either.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about people who are possibly not going to vote or going to vote third party. If I can transition for a second to talking about bringing more voters into the voting rolls. As you guys know, this week in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe is on the precipice, I think, of signing a law that will allow 200,000 convicted felons who have been pardoned, have paid their debt to society, or so it's called, are back in society, allowing them to actually get back on the voting rolls and vote. And, of course, the Republicans are saying, well, this is just, you know, a naked attempt by the Democrats to add more potential voters to the Virginia voting rolls, and Terry McAuliffe and other Democrats are saying, no, this is a way to re-enfranchise a group of people who have been disenfranchised from voting for no good reason for, you know, some 150 years. What say you?
Well,
as somebody who lives in Virginia, I'm going to jump in first,
oh, okay.
Greg, because I actually
Please.
Live here.
Fair enough. That's fair.
Sorry. First of all, it was not he's about to sign a law. He signed an executive order doing it already. It has already been done.
Thank you.
Secondly, no problem. Secondly, one of the I will state the criticisms and then state my opinions on them. One of the criticisms is that it might be including powers that were not granted to him in the state constitution of 1971. One is that it does not give full respect to victims of the criminal actions and behaviors. And the third one was what you've talked about, which is that it essentially puts a whole bunch of Democrats on the rolls just in time for November 2016. First of all, in the Constitution one, I don't think that really holds a lot of water because at least one of the folks who helped write the Constitution advised the governor on this. So that gives me the impression that I don't think that's an issue. One of the things that we have to particularly we conservatives in Virginia have to recognize is that the Constitution of 1971 gives Richmond a whole lot of power that we'd rather it didn't have. But that's a separate issue. Secondly, the victim thing, I only mention that because I have seen it raised. I think it's a rather bizarre statement. Again, these are people who have served their sentences. They have done their time. They have served their probation. The notion that somehow victims are not fully—I just don't understand it. It sounds like a straw man argument to me. And as for the last one, and I've said this on Facebook a couple times, and I'm going to stick to it. If Republicans spent as much time complaining about more Democrats voting and took that time to make it harder for voters to be Democrats, they would use their time much more efficiently. It says something that the governor himself actually had to state that for them this today when he said, you know, instead of complaining about me putting them on the voter rolls, why don't you actually try to address their issues and get them to vote for you?
Right.
And he is absolutely right.
Right.
We, as a larger issue, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, we are a party that has largely ignored urban voters and ignored inner suburban voters on the assumption that where they live automatically makes them impervious to our message, which is utterly ridiculous and untrue. The small government message can be sold in urban cities, especially if we recognize how larger government, in my opinion, actually makes their lives harder and makes it more difficult for them. Now, in some cases, that would mean removing certain favors to rural voters that Republicans have become addicted to for decades. But I digress. That's something else I have to warble about. My point is this. We should be reaching out to these voters. We should not ignore them. We should not pretend they don't exist. And we should not try to hope that they don't show up to vote. That's not the way to do this. The way to do this is to talk to them, find them out, see where they find the ones that agree with us, and get them to vote for us. We as a party have atrophied in that so much over the last several years and decades, and it really, really annoys me.
Right. In Ohio, I almost want to
applaud that. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's you said almost everything I was going to say. But in Ohio, which, as you said before, where I live in, which is one of the most important voting states, and I don't bring that up that often, but we are important. Felons are allowed to. Ex-felons, excuse me. If you are a felon, you aren't allowed. If you are currently in jail, you are not allowed to vote. But once you get out, and once you've served your time and you're off probation, you are encouraged to register to vote. There was a big scuffle a couple years ago. I like using that word because it makes me laugh. Because someone was distributing forms in urban areas that said, look, if you've ever been in jail for anything, including parking fines or something like that, you cannot vote. And no one knew who did it.
Jeez.
And, you know, and there was nothing. But these signs were posted everywhere. And it was you can bleep this out, shitty. And it wasn't true. And this law's been around for a while, but people serve their time. They deserve their rights back. It's hard enough for people who have done, you know, whatever, and to find jobs and to get back into society. Voting should be one way that they can, at least. So.
Right. And you know, I was not even aware of this issue until I saw Michael Moore's most recent movie. And I know that the word Michael Moore probably will take us off on a tangent. But but as soon as I heard the argument that this serves to do nothing but disenfranchise black men it became so apparent to me when I thought about it. There is no reason in the world. I'm going to your number two point now, DJ, because number one will be decided by the courts.
Go ahead.
And number three, the Republican Party should do but never will do. So I'm going to go right to number two, which is why shouldn't these people be allowed to vote? And the answer is there is absolutely no justification for taking the vote away from ex-felons who have served their debt to society and been put out on the streets. We let them drive. We let them have jobs. We let them eat cake. Why wouldn't they be allowed to vote? And this idea, this argument that, well, their victims aren't able to. We're not talking about 200,000 murderers who've been put out on the streets. Their victims are still alive. Their victims still have rights. Their victims still vote. Some of them were violent crimes, but the victims are still voting. So the argument that these people shouldn't be allowed to return to society and vote just holds absolutely no water at all. I'd be curious to hear somebody find a good logical reason why they shouldn't vote.
Well, I can't give you one of those. One of the issues that's been with me forever. I'm the son of a felon. And I've seen the various restrictions that go on someone when they are convicted of a felony that is nonviolent, and they serve a relatively short prison term, and they get out, and they actually can't get a job, and they can't get reintroduced into society, and they can't serve the same roles that they were before, and they can't get into training programs. And I watch the families fall apart, my family fall apart, because of stuff like this. And so the fact that I actually didn't know that Ohio allows ex-felons to vote, and I think that's fantastic. And I think that there are we know that this country has a huge problem. And maybe this is not where it came from, but I think that there's something there when you say that the prisons are a for-profit enterprise. I kind of think that prisons maybe shouldn't be, because it sort of gives a financial incentive to add more people to the prisons. So wherever that argument goes, but I don't know what the deal is. Maybe these violent folks, maybe you don't get your full scope of rights back until you're actually out of prison. That makes sense. You get your redemption. You serve your time. You pay for what you did. And then we encourage you to move on with your life. And we will help you do that and not keep you separate from everyone else.
That's right. And I would just add to that. You know, we're talking about there's some 2 million, you know, Americans in prisons. I think that we're, if not the leading country, one of the leading countries in terms of imprisoning our citizens. And that is a political issue. I mean, certainly whether drugs should be criminalized, whether people should be getting long-term convictions for selling, for distributing, for using. These are all political issues. So to take, you know, 2 million predominantly, but not exclusively, but predominantly African-American men out of society for these laws, and then not let them have some say into whether we continue these laws or we adapt these laws, to me seems very anti-democratic.
It is.
Well,
I was going to say real quick, Ohio.
No,
is
I was going to say my very brief. My ver- Go ahead.
progressive states about this, but there's only about a dozen states that have the similar laws. When I used to work at one of the offices that did that, we got called on it all the time, and we would be told, someone would call and say, "Quick, you have people registering ex-felons. We're calling the cops on you." And we'd say, "No, it's legal," and we knew this. And they'd say, "We're calling the cops on you."
It's legal in Ohio.
It's legal in Ohio. And like I said, there's only about a dozen states that does this. And so that would be number 13 or 14 or something like that. I'd have to look that up. Yeah. But it should be. I mean, that should be a federal thing. But you can't do that. That's crazy talk.
Yeah.
But as, you know, basic rights.
And as I understand my very brief and cursory review of the history of most drug laws in this country were that heroin was essentially banned because white people were afraid of Asians getting high, marijuana was banned a century ago because white people were afraid of Mexicans getting high, and cocaine was banned because white people were afraid of blacks getting high. Anybody see a pattern here? Or is it just me?
I know a guy who can get your meth. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, notice when meth and opioids started spreading through and white people started getting high, suddenly it's a medical and a treatment issue and a social crisis. Nobody's throwing the business end of law enforcement at opioids, are they?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Did you guys hear the Paul LePage comment this week when he vetoed a bipartisan law in the state of Maine that would have allowed first responders, medical first responders, to have that that special injection that can keep an OD patient alive until they get to the ER? Do you know about this?
No.
You know, as you probably know.
Yes, I did see that.
Okay.
He basically said all that Naxalone does is it keeps addicts alive until their next overdose.
Yes. He said it doesn't save lives, Paul. It just extends their lives until their next overdose. I don't know that you could construct a more racist argument, a more racist comment. This guy LePage is out of his mind.
Isn't this the guy who says his state doesn't really have a drug problem except for people of color coming in from somewhere else to deal drugs and bang white women?
Yeah, yeah, rappers.
He's a Trump backer, by the way. Yeah. Just so we're all clear. Speaking of history and race and everything else,
good segue.
I'm going to jump to the currency decision by the Treasury Department to reverse course on taking Alexander Hamilton off the front of the $10 bill, and to instead take Andrew Jackson off of the $20 bill, replace him with Harriet Tubman on the front, and make the back of the bills, the 5, the 10, and the 20, essentially more diverse in American history, to put it quickly or shortly, I should say. Most of the argument, no surprise, most people are happy that Hamilton has stayed. There are some people who are claiming, bizarrely, that Jackson should stay in the 20. I have beaten them up all over the blogosphere. And, of course, Donald Trump thinks Harriet Tubman should be on the $2 bill because putting her on the 20 is complete and utter political correctness, as he put it. Not really surprised, given that Donald Trump really is the 21st century reincarnation of Andrew Jackson, at least in my opinion. So
he's going to march. Curious, the Mexicans back to the border. He's not going to drive them.
He'll make them walk. We're going to have a trail of tears. It's going to be a big
trail of
tears.
It's going to be the best trail.
It's going to stretch for 50 miles.
It'll be huge.
It'll be a huge trail, and the Mexicans will pay for the trail to be paved. Oh. It's going to be gold-lined, and we're going to win that trail. I don't know how you win a trail, but he'll figure it out.
It'll be a super highway of tears.
I am curious. Is there anyone in the group, because I'm certainly not one, who thinks Jackson should stay on the 20?
Oh, I don't even use 20s anymore. I mean,
I have two problems with the change. One is, I'm actually in favor of Tubman being on one of the bills. I think that she was a great choice. My concern is if you take Jackson off of the front and you put Harriet Tubman on, you know, from now on, anytime I go into a restaurant and I want to bribe the maitre d', I have to say reservation for Harriet Tubman. That's not going to sound very good. And you guys didn't get that at all. And then
the nicest place I go is Applebee's.
And then my other question is, as they used to say when we were kids,
Kevin, that joke was so funny, I forgot to laugh.
Yes, right. Or hitting your forehead with your hand, saying, "I got it in here, right here, my friend, right here."
Something like that.
My other logistical problem with this is, if you put Jackson on the back, the quote-unquote back of the $20 bill, you put Tubman on the front, how do we know which is the back and which is the front? And how do I arrange my wallet?
The OCDs are going. It's going to drive some people crazy, isn't it? Well, Jackson's going to be off completely, won't he?
Oh yeah, Hamilton. No, so Hamilton goes up. No, Hamilton's on the 10. No, Hamilton's on the 10. Jackson's going
Hamilton
on the back.
Stays
on the
front. Stays in the front of the 10.
Yeah.
Is he going on the back of the 20?
Well, that's
okay. Right. I know he's definitely off the front. I don't know whether he's on the back or not.
Isn't that what you said, DJ? That's what I think I heard.
Hamilton
in the
stays on the 10. Jackson's off completely.
Yeah. I knew Jackson was coming off the 20. If I said he was coming on, going on the back of the 20,
Jackson is
mistaken.
Sorry,
I think
Mr.
I actually
Jackson.
Heard that someplace, actually, that he was going to go on the back of one of the bills, and then the other one is going to get a president to be named later or something.
No. He's gone. Like a violent femme song.
Good.
Gone, baby,
so
gone.
I know...
Good riddance to bad rubbish, I say.
Yeah, we have a couple listeners from outside the country who may not know, but Andrew Jackson was the president that we all pretty much agree committed genocide. And we can argue about some of the others. In fact, like he created some policies, and then the next guy, Van Buren, is the one who finished the genocide. But that's kind of why he's the main reason why he's on the outs these days. It took us forever to agree that maybe one of our presidents killed many more people than he should have. It's kind of weird when you think about it.
This is something that we have forgotten for various reasons, but Jackson's policy was very controversial at the time. Mm-hmm. It was nearly defeated in Congress. It actually required Van Buren whipping the New York Democrats to get it through. As we know, it was taken to the Supreme Court and invalidated by the Supreme Court. Jackson basically told the Supreme Court to get lost. And of the two lawyers who took the case to the Supreme Court, one of them ran as Henry Clay's vice president in 1832, and the other one ran as the anti-Mason candidate for president in 1832, William Wirt. Between them, I think they actually managed to deny Jackson. Well, they didn't quite deny Jackson a northern majority in 1832, but they did manage to take the Senate, the U.S. Senate, out of Jackson's hands in 1832, even as he was being reelected on his bank veto. This was a major issue that divided the two parties until the bank, and even to somewhat afterwards. One of the reasons it was forgotten for years was because, essentially, after the Civil War, most historians didn't pay attention to the Whigs, didn't pay attention to the National Republicans, assumed they basically stood for nothing except hatred of Andrew Jackson. And they didn't bother to really look and say, oh no, wait a minute. They actually had some substantive differences with Jackson, and one of them was on Indian removal. And that was something that has only recently been recognized by historians. And that was why I think the debate on Jackson has come around now, is that everybody knew that, yes, he did a horrible thing with the Indian Removal Act, but I think the assumption most historians had up until about 20, 30 years ago was, well, yes, he did something terrible, but it was just part of a very racist time in America, and nobody really cared about those Native American tribes anyway. We now know differently. We now know that that was very divisive, and that there were a lot of Americans who thought that was complete bunk and BS. And because of that, I think we are now more comfortable with getting rid of Jackson, because we realize that in getting rid of Jackson, what we're really doing is that we're validating his critics, and we're saying, you know, after 180 years, you were right.
Yeah. And by the way, I just looked it up, and they are bumping him to the back. Whether you misspoke or whether I just misheard you, DJ, he is in some form or fashion going to be on the back.
He's still on the back?
At least that's what they're saying on a couple of the sites that I just checked, yeah.
Right, but the thing,
then the victory is incomplete. Fight must go on until he is removed from that bill entirely.
But the bill doesn't come out until 2030. I don't know if you guys have read this.
Yes,
the bill doesn't come
correct.
Out.
I heard they were trying to accelerate it to 2020.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
I read somewhere they were trying to accelerate it.
Well,
but even if it is 30-30, that would be the bicentennial of the Indian Removal Act being signed into law, so it would be at least somewhat symmetrical in that.
That would interesting. Be.
So,
okay, what other topics should we cover in our final moments?
Well, it was. I'm going to go with what the president decided to do today. I mean, there was a lot of craziness in East Asia, but Beijing and Pyongyang always act. Beijing and Pyongyang bullied everybody else in the neighborhood. Are we really surprised?
No.
It's what they do. They throw their weight around and they hope nobody notices. But the president, interestingly enough, went over to London and decided. Well, he was invited by the British government to get involved in the Brexit debate. And for those of you who don't know what that is, among the listeners, that is on the 23rd of June, the British people will vote as to whether or not to leave the European Union. The British government very much wants the people to vote to stay. So the Prime Minister, who is very close to the President, invited him to London and basically sat back while the President cajoled and all but threatened the British people to stay in the European Union. It created something of a backlash, not as much as people think, mainly because everybody knew that the Prime Minister pretty much wanted the President to say exactly what he said. But it's really the first time that I have seen this is really the first time I've seen this president get that deeply involved in another country's affairs. And I don't necessarily say that as a bad thing, because I think, and there are a lot of Republicans who'd think he should have just kept his mouth shut, but for one, the British government asked him to say something. There is an argument that could be made that it is better for America if Britain stays in the EU. I frankly think that argument is bunk, but the president obviously thinks the argument is real, so he has a right to express himself. And I think it's one of these things where in democracies, you know, I don't necessarily mind that leaders get involved in, that a leader of one country gets involved in the leader of another country's election. And maybe it's just me, and maybe I'm just weird because I follow politics in several countries now, but, you know, it's not the 19th or the 20th centuries. It's a much larger world. It's a more interconnected world. Like it's a more interconnected world now. And the notion of leaders commenting one way or the other across in ideological ways, you know, it's something we should expect.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's not a bad thing. I'm glad he made a comment. I mean, he won't even endorse Hillary or Bernie at this point. It's driving us nuts. And yet he's making these. Jeez, get on with it already.
But he endorsed the EU.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I like to think that it goes to show the fact that they came to him and said, hey, obviously you're pretty popular over here, or you're someone that the British people like. I mean, everyone...
Which is true.
People,
he's very popular in Britain.
He's popular, which I always hear from a lot of my Republican friends about how, oh my goodness, people all over the world are embarrassed of Obama. Everyone is just because he just gets kicked around. And I go, I don't think so. I think he's a pretty popular president, you know, in a lot of European countries and in these places. And I know they always say, like, death to America in the Middle East, but I think they say that, like, year-round, you know, to everybody. But I think he's a much popular president.
There are a lot of... Yeah.
Yeah.
There are a lot of places where there are a lot of places where the president is unpopular. The United Kingdom is not one of them.
Right. And particularly
and I personally
this president.
Think, although I am... Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, Republicans...
And although... Yeah.
I was going to say, Republicans always say that the world does not respect this president, and he's, you know, debasing our level of respect across the land. And then when he says something, they're saying, oh, he's got too much power. He shouldn't be influencing people like that. So either he has influence and they respect him, or he doesn't. But you can't have it both ways. And the other thing that I would say is, I know that you were probably just, you know, trying to make a colorful point when you said he's never gotten this involved in another country's affairs before. I would argue that sending U.S. Marines or special forces into a country is a lot more involved than talking about how they should vote on an EU issue.
Well, okay, I guess I should say in terms of another democratic country, I think I see your point. In terms of Afghanistan, or in this case now Syria, where he's putting some special forces in. But I think, you know, I think the one thing that I think history will look more kindly on more kindly upon the president than most of his contemporaries do right now is how he has managed the relationship with the UK. Yes, he treated Gordon Brown terribly, but you know what? Half of Britain treated Gordon Brown terribly. He was not a very popular guy. Most Americans didn't recognize that. But the Obama-Cameron relationship, and for those who don't know, David Cameron is the Prime Minister of Britain since 2010, that has been a very good relationship. It has been very tight. They have managed to do, I think, some good things together, some not-so-good things together. But the special relationship, as it is known, is still special, and Barack Obama and David Cameron have done quite a bit to make it special, and that's something where, frankly, even though I'm a Republican, I see what Obama has done, and I think he deserves some credit for that, because it is, the special relationship has in fact grown under this president, particularly under this president and the current prime minister. And like I said, I don't think he gets enough credit for that. I also think we are pretty much out of time.
I agree.
So let us jump quickly to predictions, and I'll make it very simple. Do the front runners lose any states on Tuesday? I am going to say no. Jonah?
I think no. I think no. Although the Bernie people were out, they came to my house, so they're not going gently into this good night, but they're out there, they're trying. But
do you get a hose and do you like say,
I get out of here?
The guy was like, "Do you want a button?" And I thought, "Do I?
Oh, get it?
You do
for your collection? Absolutely,
absolutely."
I was like,
"Free shit."
I guess maybe I do. He pulled one right out of his pocket. Here you go. I'm like, all right, thanks, man.
Was it like a grandfather?
Okay, so that's two no's. Like Kevin?
Well, I'm going to go a little longer. I'm going to say, first of all, I think Hillary wins 4 out of 5. I have no idea how Mr. Trump is going to do. I think she's going to she might struggle a little bit in Rhode Island. Not that it's going to be a struggle. You asked earlier in the podcast, I think it was your first question, which is, what is the make or break, situation for the Democrats? And I want to just very quickly go back and say, I think it's Indiana. If Hillary beats Sanders in Indiana, that is the final nail in his coffin, because for months they've been telling us that he is going to win Indiana, and now it looks like he's not. And then the only other prediction that I want to make is that our friend Emily gets well again and is back next week and has a kick-ass podcast.
Indeed, nice. And I'm sure you'll be right on that. And Greg?
I think it's going to be 4 out of 5. Also, I think Clinton will have struggles in Connecticut, actually. I think that's the one. Or am I getting it mixed up with Maryland?
Hey, that's Nader's home state, so perhaps.
Oh, my God. Once again, if I
talk
have
about
three
circular.
Punches,
that's great.
If I have 3 free punches in this world, 2 would be for Mike Love, 2 would be for Mike Love, and 1 would be for Nader. If I could just get away with it, and then I think
all right then,
and then Trump will do just fine. I'm not worried about him. He's got good people. He's got the best people watching him. He's got professionals.
Right.
Good
he's
people.
Got him and his best people. And that is all we have for this week. Don't forget to find us on the web at moreperfectunionpodcast.com, including blogs and commentary. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. Share our link on Facebook, too. And rate and review us on iTunes. That's all again. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.